Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the Central Asia in Focus newsletter. On the first day of July 2022, Uzbek security forces brutally suppressed a large but peaceful protest in Nukus, the capital of the Karakalpakstan Sovereign Republic. People in Nukus were demonstrating against proposed amendments to Uzbekistan's constitution that would have stripped any references to sovereignty in Karakalpakstan. Officially, 21 people were killed, almost all of them protesters, and most of them died from wounds obviously inflicted by security forces. Suspects were rounded up and put on trial. All of them were from the protesters, and all were ethnic Karakalpaks. Show trials convicted 61 people, and enforced calm was imposed upon Karakalpakstan. Problems for Karakalpak activists outside Uzbekistan started shortly after the July 2022 violence. Several Karakalpak activists in Kazakhstan have been detained, including the recent detention of one of the leading spokesmen for the Karakalpaks, Akilbek Muratbay. Two Karakalpaks in Europe currently face the prospect of deportation. To discuss all this, I am joined by Arzu, a pseudonym for a native of Karakalpakstan, now living outside Uzbekistan. And in the interest of protecting her identity, we are taking Arzu's comments and using a different voice for this podcast. Catherine Putz, managing editor at the Diplomat magazine, Lila Sait Beck, chairwoman of the NGO Freedom for Eurasia, and joining us in the second half of the program will be Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer who has spent many years focusing on Central Asia and is currently an associate professor at the University of Southern California. Thank you all for joining me. And Arzu, I want to start with you. Before we get into individual cases, can you tell me what the recent events, detentions, and the what look like the deportations of Karakalpaks, how is this resonating in the Karakalpak community?
People are devastated that not only are they being hard-pressed in Karakalpakstan, but outside of its territory in Kazakhstan or even in Austria, where you would expect the Western country to be more mindful about the issues. But we were shocked by the way the Austrian government handled the asylum case. Not only did they deport him, but the way they treated him was also very disappointing. They confiscated the little money he had and they took away his cell phone. He didn't have any communication. And of course, in Poland, it's even worse the way he's treated. He hasn't eaten for a few days, so we are very upset about the current events.
And of course, we're talking about Koshkarbay Murata. So I'm going to add, Lila, you've been following this case. And actually, you have an update you can give us on Todomuratov's situation.
Yes, thank you, Bruce, for organizing this podcast on Karakalpak issues. This seems to be a topic that is very, very unknown to the people in the West. And those audiences in the West are actually now the ones who, many of them are decision makers. And we'll be deciding the fate of Karakalpaks that have managed to flee the repressions. The situation of Koshkarbay Todomuratov has been quite complicated in the last several days. He applied for asylum in Austria, but unfortunately, it was decided, according to the Dublin regulation, that the country that is responsible for his asylum application is Poland, because that's where he entered Europe in 2023, and he also held a visa issued by Poland. So he was transferred to Poland, I believe, on the 27th or 28th of February. Don't remember the exact date right now, unfortunately. The transfer was also quite harsh because he was deprived of food and water for extensive periods of time. His luggage was lost. Some of his devices were lost. His devices were also confiscated for extensive periods of time where he was left with no communication. He was finally brought to Warsaw Airport and he was detained there until the Polish court decided whether or not he should be detained further pending his asylum procedure or whether or not he should be released and live elsewhere and enjoy his freedom and participate in the asylum procedure without the need to be locked up in a closed camp for asylum seekers. His treatment in the airport initially was quite harsh as well because the Polish authorities somehow at the airport told him that they actually told a lot of absurd things. They told him that there is no asylum for Uzbek citizens. They tried to deny his right to lodge an asylum application initially. But then we were able to get our colleagues, human rights organizations in Poland involved, the Association for Legal Intervention and the Helsinki Foundation for Human Rights. So both of them got involved. They have reached out to the border guards at the airport. They have sent their lawyer over and provided an opinion of human rights organizations to the judge. And thankfully, you know, the efforts of everybody's joint efforts basically helped to get him released today in the morning.
Okay, thank you. But before I go, I leave. Tore Marata was actually one of the Karakalpaks who was detained in Kazakhstan, right, a couple of years ago, and was in detention for like a year. Is that true?
Yes. Yes, yes. He was one of the five Karakalpaks that were detained in 2023, I think, right? 2022, I don't remember, a year ago. And he spent a year in a Kazakh prison due to extradition request by Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan has accused Karakalpaks living in Kazakhstan, him and his other colleagues from the diaspora, of conspiring to violently overthrow the constitutional order in Uzbekistan. And among them was also a pediatric cardiologist, several other activists who really aren't, you know, the type that would actually be able to do any of the things that Uzbek authorities have accused them of.
Thanks. Katie? Let's talk about some of the Karakalpaks who are detained or were detained in Kazakhstan, but I'm thinking specifically about Akil Bek, Murat Bey. I know that you just recently did an article about him for The Diplomat, too. Can you talk about his case, please?
Yeah, so Akil Bek was detained in mid-February in Kazakhstan on an extradition request from Uzbekistan. He has lived in Kazakhstan for a decade, I believe, and for most of that decade wasn't really an activist. He was involved with the diaspora community on cultural issues, on labor migrant stuff, but he wasn't really political in any sense of the word until Akash Karbai was arrested in September of 2022. And that's when he explained to me over several conversations, that's when he really felt that he needed to get involved and start speaking up. He speaks very good English, which makes him a great source for journalists. And I think that's one of the reasons that he is now in trouble, is that he has been very outspoken, but very reasonably outspoken, I would say. He's not sort of one of those, one of these kind of crazy people who's sort of just shouting into the ether of the internet. He was very meticulous about documenting cases, particularly in Kazakhstan, of Karakalpaks under pressure. Including the five who spent a year in prison. All of them were ultimately released, but also denied asylum. And so he now has sort of found himself in the same situation as those five. He carries an Uzbek passport still, and that sets him apart as opposed to other activists who have acquired Kazakh citizenship or have moved elsewhere, sort of have another layer of protection, though we can certainly talk about the sort of veneer of that maybe. But yeah, so he, the current status that I understand from sort of regional reporting is that he's been given asylum seeker status, which should protect him from extradition at least through May, I believe, through the end of May. It's 3 months, has the potential of being extended another 3 months and should have him at least be considered for refugee status in Kazakhstan. I think it's most likely he will not be given refugee status in Kazakhstan. None of the other Karakalpaks, to my knowledge, have, but hopefully he will not be deported or extradited to Uzbekistan. And so that's the sort of current status of Akil Bek.
Okay, thank you. And I'm sure we'll get back to him during the course of the conversation. But before we leave the topic of Karakalpak diaspora leaders, Arzu, could you describe or tell us a little bit about Niyat Bey Orozbayev, please?
Niyetbey Orazbayev, he was one of the leaders of Qarakalpak diaspora in Kazakhstan. He was very knowledgeable about the issues of Qarakalpak people, and he was a very peaceful person. He was focused mostly on preserving Qarakalpak culture and language, and it was devastating when Kazakh government stripped his citizenship, and it caused tremendous stress on him. And most likely that was the reason of his death, and also that he was vulnerable and his family were not able to bury his body in Qarakalpakstan according to his wish, because Uzbek government would not allow that.
Thank you, Arzu, for that description. You know, also before, I would be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the case of Nauruzbay Menlibayev. He's another Qarakalpak activist, and an important one too, that came from Uzbekistan. He's actually the founder of a couple movements. Laila, I know that Freedom for Eurasia has written about him. Can you tell us what his status is now? Where is he?
Yeah. So Menlibayev also tried to apply for asylum in Austria, and he fled Poland for the same reason that Koshkarbay did. They both, and the other Qarakalpaks as well, were they received death threats and also warnings from Uzbek diplomats at the conference, at the OSCE ODIHR conference, that they will either be killed or they will be removed from Poland, that they will somehow will get them back into Uzbekistan and will deal with them there. So they both fled. And Nauruzbay was also transferred from Austria to Poland under the Dublin procedure, because Poland was the first safe country that he entered the Europe through. So he was returned with his wife and his baby. I think his baby is about 1.5 years old. His return was somewhat less harsh. And I think perhaps that was due to him having a small child with him. Although also the transfer was quite, they were deprived of food, they were deprived of water, which obviously the baby took quite, it was exhausted. But he was not detained upon arrival. He is trying to re-enter his asylum procedure that he had in Poland. We are working on it. I don't know at this moment what the decision of Polish authorities will be on his situation, whether or not they will continue his existing procedure or they will want to start a new one. We don't know that yet, but also we have asked our Polish colleagues to engage. So hopefully it will not be as complicated.
Okay, thank you. Katie, I was wondering if you could also talk about, we'll go back to Kazakhstan here for a second, since Akobek is still in detention technically, although he's looking for asylum status. What has happened to the Qarakalpaks who were detained? Can you take us through their situation and how that ended?
Yeah, so the five that I'm aware of that were detained, most of them, I believe, between sort of September and November of 2022, all of them spent a year in prison, which is apparently the legal limit in Kazakhstan, and then they were released. So none of them were extradited back to Uzbekistan, which is what the Uzbek authorities had requested. They were allowed to stay in Kazakhstan. After that, many or all of them applied for asylum, applied for refugee status in Kazakhstan. Those cases, to my knowledge, all of them were denied. Kazakhstan doesn't often grant refugee status. The last numbers I saw is in sort of the mere hundreds, many of them from Afghanistan. There's not many from Uzbekistan that have gotten refugee status in Kazakhstan, though I would imagine there's been some who have applied. And, I think for me, it sort of mirrors some of what we saw with regard to Uyghurs who fled China into Kazakhstan. sort of fleeing persecution in Xinjiang. They would apply for refugee status in Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan would consider it and then deny it. And then they would essentially sort of live in this murky in-between state where they're sort of allowed to stay, but are on sort of flimsy legal ground to do so. They can't go back, in the case of the Uyghurs, to China, in the case of the Karakol Paks, to Karakol Pakistan or Uzbekistan without sort of facing trouble. So many sort of move on then to European countries where their refugee applications are more likely to be accepted and they're more likely to find asylum. It's by no means guaranteed. And so, you know, these people live in a very precarious situation where there's not really a place that they can be safe necessarily. And I do want to sort of go back to the question you had for Arzu about Niyatbay Orozbayev. You know, I spoke to him in May, I think it was May of 2023, after sort of the trial in absentia that he and another sort of Karakol Pak abroad were convicted and sentenced to sort of long sentences. And one of the things that he said to me then was that he was, you know, he was really worried that he would just be sort of packaged off to Uzbekistan in the night. And I think that that worry certainly drove a lot of the stress that he was under. And then with the stripping of his Kazakh citizenship, that became an even more likely possibility that he would just sort of be taken in the night and packaged off to Uzbekistan. And so, you know, he unfortunately passed away in January, I believe it was. But, you know, that's a lot of stress to live under, to be uncertain of your safety anywhere. And that's the reality that I think this community lives with.
I would like to echo what Katya said about the stress. I spoke to Raisa Kudaybergeno. She is a cardiologist in Kazakhstan, and she's experiencing health issues, major health issues. And on top of that, she says that every day she has a fear that someone will come and deport her to Uzbekistan, and she is also concerned for her children. So activists in Kazakhstan right now, they are experiencing lots of instability and uncertainty. Who is it going to be alive tomorrow or not?
Yeah, understandable. And I should mention, too, that in the case of Kazakhstan and asylum seekers, that even Katie had mentioned that Uyghurs couldn't get asylum there, but even ethnic Kazakhs from Xinjiang have not been allowed to, if they illegally cross the border, they've had problems trying to get asylum in Kazakhstan. We've reached the halfway point, so I want to remind everybody that we're talking about the plight of the Karakol Pak activists outside Uzbekistan, and my guests are Catherine Putz, managing editor at The Diplomat magazine, Lila Sait Beck, chairwoman of the NGO Freedom for Eurasia, Arzu, a pseudonym for a native of Karakol Pakistan who is now living outside Uzbekistan. And shortly, we should be joined by Steve Sverdlov, a rights lawyer who spent many years focusing on Central Asia and is currently an associate professor at the University of Southern California. Lila, I want to start with you on this part. What can the Karakol Paks do to bump up their profile, so to speak, you know, to get the more wider publicity for their situation? I mean, your organization is working on it. I'm going to ask you the same question in a minute, Katie. But, you know, is social networks enough? That seems to be what they're focusing on at the moment.
Well, there are many things they can do. And this, you know, civic mobilization for Karakol Pak seems to be, you know, problematic simply because they are this very suppressed society within a very suppressed society. So, you know, all the filters that Uzbekistan has on its own civil society, it's like a double for them. So, and they're like further away, right, from everybody else, because the world has been sort of like looking at the Uzbek problem in general, and weren't even seeing Karakol Pak issue behind that, except for the instances when Uzbekistan was kind of, you know, using Karakol Pak issue as an instrument to boost their own agendas elsewhere on the international arena, you know, talking about the climate change or whatnot, talking about the RLC problems and maybe kind of, you know, trying to talk about some efforts to correct it and stuff. But generally, they were shielded from everybody else. And I think what Karakol Paks are now doing, you know, how they have mobilized themselves and how they are exchanging information and reaching out to journalists and reaching out to international organizations and talking about their problems, just being outspoken, really, is what really is going to make a big difference for them, you know, for the world to at least start seeing them, seeing their problems, seeing the discrimination that they have to face on a daily basis, the repressions that they have to face. This is very important and actually very impressive, the courage that they are now showing in bringing up their issue to the international level. Yeah, so the more they talk about it, the more chance there is that the Uzbek authorities finally will find, you know, strength in themselves to at least start talking to them, talking about, you know, the issues that they face instead of trying to suppress the problems altogether. Yeah. This is very important what they're doing, and also for the researchers that focus on various issues, including the issues of ethnic minorities, or, you know, those that are researching repressions, anything that is connected to Karakalpak issue. You know, the more material there is, the more thorough and deeper research there is available for them. Will be very important in the coming years anyway. What also is interesting is, and I'm very happy that this has happened, is that this narrative that was put forward by Uzbek authorities, you know, painting Karakalpaks as these separatists and extremists, that this narrative has finally changed. And now we see that these people aren't, you know, separatists or extremists, and what has been happening to them at least since the 2022. And the reason why these protests happened wasn't actually, you know, Karakalpaks actually trying to break off of Uzbekistan, that it was just them trying to preserve the constitution in the way it was. And they were not the ones who were actually trying to overthrow the constitutional order. In fact, they were trying to preserve it, and they were trying to preserve the clause that provided them the right, even when the time comes, to vote whether or not they want to secede or not, or whether they want to stay within Uzbekistan, which, you know, which is a right they want to keep, and that's understandable. At the same time, it would be wiser for Uzbek authorities to actually just, you know, do their job, do what they're there for, and make their lives such that they wouldn't want to leave, that they would find it more beneficial for them to stay together with Uzbekistan.
Okay, thank you. Katie, I want to ask you kind of the same question. You know, since you did just have that article about Karakalpaks, did you get any response? And what was it like to pitch the article? I mean, you know, we're trying to figure out how well known the Karakalpaks are, and look at some of the challenges they face in getting their message out.
Yeah, certainly. Well, the short answer is that I pitched it to myself, and I agreed with myself that I wanted to write about it, and so I wrote about it. I have a lot of leeway for what it is that I get to write about at The Diplomat. But that said, you know, when it comes to paying attention to specific issues, you know, it is hard to break through. There is a lot going on in the world. That's, you know, an understatement of the year. There's a lot going on in Asia, which is the regions that The Diplomat covers. And, you know, I think when it comes to issues like the Karakalpak issue, the first barrier is a language one. You know, it is my Russian is terrible, and I don't speak Uzbek. And so, you know, I think being able to communicate what is happening in this community to journalists, both within the region, within the wider sort of Russian-speaking sphere, and then in Europe, that requires European languages, the United States and the UK, that requires English. And so there are these language barriers that make it difficult. I think this is one of the reasons that Akelbach was such a great source, is because his English was really good, and he was very meticulous about documenting what was going on. And so, you know, when I think about what the Karakalpak community should do, you know, one of those things is documenting in whatever language that they can document these things in, document what has happened and when. And then with that, try to communicate to people who do have some kind of platform to write about these things. And that's, it is difficult, you know, pitching a story is, can be really difficult. Not all journalists will be interested in this, but some certainly would be. And it takes kind of persistence and diligence, and a bit of kind of, diplomacy to really reach out to people who have an opportunity to write about something. Now, for myself, and like is probably the wrong word, but I like writing about issues like this because they're not being covered. But these are people who want to live. I think Layla explained it really clearly. You know, the Karakalpak people just want to live their lives. The Uzbek constitution guarantees them certain rights. It even guarantees them the right to talk about those rights, but that's the problem. The Uzbek state doesn't want them to talk about these issues. And so that's where this sort of tension comes from. You know, I think the events of 2022, the summer of 2022, is very much an own goal on Tashkent. You know, proposing those specific changes to the constitution were essentially unnecessary. And really triggered the conversations that they really don't want to be happening. But, you know, the Karakalpak people have the right to have this conversation. It's literally in the constitution that they have the right to have this conversation. The problem is that the laws in Uzbekistan and the way that those are enforced, you know, I always find it sort of darkly amusing that, you know, the charge is often, you know, a threat to the constitutional order, but they're talking about the constitution and the constitutional order, not getting, you know, their discussion is about preserving it, not about changing it. And so, you know, I think that's always sort of a bit ironic. But back to your, you know, question, I think, you know, it takes sort of diligence and often tying these issues to larger issues. You know, I think what is happening in Karakalpakstan is indicative of the way that Uzbekistan and Uzbek authorities still approach dissent and still approach sort of opposition. You know, it might be gentler in other parts of Uzbekistan, but it is not wholly different. And so I think some of those connections could be important. You know, I think the Karakalpaks sort of fall into a category of peoples, and there's a lot of differences in the list that I'm about to sort of lay out, but they fall into a category of peoples whose sort of cultural nation exists within a larger sort of modern nation state, but doesn't quite belong to it. So you have the Pamiris in Tajikistan, you have the Rohingya in Myanmar, you have the Uyghurs in China, and the Tibetans in China, and these people all sort of have tensions and difficulties with the states that they ostensibly belong to, when really those states should be protecting and helping preserve their cultures. They're really trying to destroy them. And that's really unfortunate.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Let's see if we can get Steve here. Can you speak a little bit about the legal cases against these people? Let's start with the Karakalpaks who are in Kazakhstan. I mean, legally, how can you detain them and on what charge?
Well, what we see are the classic collection, I guess you could say, even I might even use the phrase the greatest hits of the Uzbek government when they go after political dissent of any kind. Article 159, which is the attempt to overthrow the constitutional order. Article 244, various parts of that, which essentially criminalize the distribution or the dissemination of so-called extremist literature. These are really since the late 90s, since Karimov enshrined this really repressive system and Mirzoyev has continued it, are the articles that are so broad, they're so vague that they can essentially be used to criminalize anything the government deems as threatening. And, you know, this is one of the most sensitive areas for the government. And as I think I heard Katie mentioning a few moments ago, the absurdity, of course, of all of these cases is that the very acts that are being punished, the discussion of the autonomy, of the sovereignty, of the constitutional referendum process around Karakalpakstan are actually enshrined in not only the new, but also the old versions of the Uzbek constitution. And so they're punishing essentially the core constitutional rights that exist in addition to the right of free speech or the right of freedom of expression, which also exists in the Uzbek constitution. So all the cases are built around these overbroad notions of extremism and terrorism. And as we can see, they affect those inside Uzbekistan and inside the Republic of Karakalpakstan, and they extend outward to Kazakhstan, to Russia, and transnationally, you know, to all, also beyond that to Europe. And we also see that in the recent round of repression, the case concerning Akılbek Muratbay, who has been, to my mind, one of the most helpful, most constructive, most professional voices and an always peaceful voice. His case and also the case of Koshkarabai Turumuratov, in addition to some others, also seem to hinge recently more on the fact that the Karakalpak activist community was using a very important forum, the OSCE Human Dimension Implementation Meeting, which we've seen, Bruce, you know, over many years, a lot of repression coming down on the heads of activists in Central Asia who go and dare to use that forum, which is Europe's largest human rights conference, where activists and governments can sit down at one table and speak about issues. And because the Karakalpak activist community decided to utilize that conference to raise issues and human rights issues, they really got the attention of Tashkent and the security services. And so we've seen the legal cases around Koshkarabai and also Akılbek circulating around the posting of videos of presentations by activists at that meeting.
Okay, thanks. And now that we got you, I'm going to force you to make up for not being here on right at the start and give you lots of time here. What about the situation in Europe, legally speaking? I mean, we had two Karakalpak activists who suddenly had problems in February. Legally, what happened there?
Well, there's different levels of problems here. And, you know, one issue, of course, is the so-called Dublin Protocol. And I'm not a European immigration lawyer, but I can tell you that one of the things that has been a continuing source of difficulty for not just for Karakalpaks, but Central Asian asylum seekers in general is the really inhospitable climate to migrants and especially to Central Asians in Europe for many years now, at least dating back to the migration crisis around 2015 that we know was related to mostly Afghans and also Syrians. But in that inhospitable climate, we've seen migration authorities really not understanding, not even seeking to understand the severity and the level of risk that Karakalpak activists and others face when they engage in peaceful human rights activism or political opposition activity. And so what we've seen recently is an enforcement of the Dublin rule, which basically says that if you've set foot first on one European country, you have to seek asylum there. And so a number of activists that have been in Austria or sometimes in France or Germany have gone there, have been returned to Poland if that's the first place that they set foot when they entered the territory of the European Union or of the Schengen zone, I should be more precise. And the problem with that is that Poland has been, along with some of the other states, has been distinguishing itself in creating real risks of extraditing or forcibly returning Karakalpaks and Central Asians back to Central Asia where they could be tortured. Now, the key issue there is my favorite French term, non-refoulement. It's the basic principle that you cannot return someone to a country where they could face torture or substantial likelihood of harm. And in recent years, as Leila and Katie know so well, we've had some troubling cases, not just concerning Karakalpaks, but also Tajiks. For example, Germany returned someone, Abdullah Hisham Sidin, to Tajikistan, which resulted in a long prison sentence. Austria returned someone. Poland also, just last summer. And so there's a real risk here that the Karakalpak community has to face, and they have no real access to legal resources, to representation, to quality legal representation that would help them. Of course, organizations like Freedom for Eurasia are doing amazing work helping them as a first line of defense. But I think what this shows us is that we need real resources to protect Central Asians that are in this situation in Europe. We also need, I think, on the level of the UN, we do need transnational repression experts to be looking at the connection between repression in Central Asia and the way in which these extradition requests are really being used aggressively in Europe to silence peaceful dissent. So all of that is happening at the same time as we have the wave of arrests in Kazakhstan. We have the intimidation of students in Karakalpakstan itself. We've had reports of increased repression in Russia recently related to Akılbek Muratbay's case. So all of this is happening transnationally, and it should worry us, and it really requires a creative response.
Thank you. Leda, I'm curious, since you are in Europe, I mean, without going into the process too much, but do the European officials ever consult with your organization, or who do they consult with? If they've detained someone who's a Karakalpak, do they bother to do some background research and contact organizations that might know something more about the situation in Karakalpakstan?
Well, they usually consult, the existing sort of like encyclopedias that they usually use. There are a number of resources that they have traditionally used about the, basically with a description of various countries. But the problem is that those resources often have very basic information and don't really go into depth. And even if that information about a certain country, say about Uzbekistan or about Tajikistan, even if that resource provides an information that that's a repressive regime, you can't return activists to that regime. The asylum authorities often ignore that, and they start playing the game of, finding or, in some way to argue that the person can be returned. And I can give you an example. That example that, for example, Steve just mentioned out of Austria, where they have returned a political activist, a civil activist, to Tajikistan. And in that situation, what they did was they said, well, yes, we understand that the person that you're talking about, that you're saying you are, might be in danger, but we don't think that's you. And they have sent him out. The person, I think he got 25 years in jail for his activism and was accused of treason. In other cases, the European authorities, one of the asylum denials about a woman who was raped in Gkhanbend, the decision, the judge actually said, well, the rape, took place many years ago, so she should be okay. We don't know why she should be traumatized. It's okay. It's nothing terrible. And they just make these really callous decisions, and I really don't know where they get the ideas of how to sort of like, intricately argue in order to make everything to enable the country to deport the person. So what I feel from these asylum cases is that the authorities aren't really looking for ways to help this person stay. They, on contrary, do everything possible and impossible to make sure that the person is removed from the country. So whenever you provide tons of evidence, they will go and they will argue that that's not enough. Or they will just say that they don't believe you. That's it. I mean, they won't even provide you reasons of why. They just say that you're not believable. That's it. And I know about the asylum procedure, not only from a professional point of view as a person who helps the asylum seekers, but also as a person that was in the asylum procedure for 6 years. I was in an Austrian asylum procedure for 6 years. It's a very difficult, very stressful process. It's difficult to fight even for a person with a legal background. And so, for our dissidents that are coming from Central Asia and usually aren't lawyers, to face that is a very, very difficult challenge. And I feel very sorry for them. They come out very traumatized. They come out very stressed out. They probably, I don't know, it will take them years to get over it.
Okay, thanks. We're running short on time. And that's unfortunate. But so I'm going to give everyone a chance to make a last comment. Katie, I'd like to start with you. it seems to me like the problem for Karakalpak is we don't know that much about what's happening in Uzbekistan. We get some hints and stuff, but even the Karakalpak outside Uzbekistan, it seems like the situation is getting worse for them. Do you get that feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, you know, to go back to one of the things that you mentioned at the top is, you know, or it might have been in a previous discussion that we've had, in certainly since the events of July 2022, the pressure sort of ratcheted up first on Karakalpak activists inside of Karakalpakstan and then those outside of Uzbekistan. And that sort of taps into this larger trend of transnational repression that we see, you know, but I think it does seem to be getting worse. And I don't know how much further that can go, because at a certain point you start running out of people to harass, maybe. But there's this, it just seems to be going in the wrong direction. And, you know, there might have been a point at which discussion and conversation was possible between the Karakalpak community, both outside of Uzbekistan and in Karakalpakstan, and the Uzbek state. But, you know, there's such a deficit of trust at this point that I don't know who would talk to whom and how they could possibly approach some kind of reasonable coexistence. You know, there might have been a world in which that existed, but Tashkent doesn't seem interested in that possibility. And to be frank, you know, why would the Karakalpak community at this point want to talk to the Uzbek state? And I think that's a difficulty that if Uzbekistan wants to sort of move past this, they're going to have to reckon with that, because the Karakalpak people are not going to disappear. There's you know, it is a group of people that has a significant diaspora at this point. And there are people who really care about this. I keep going back to something that Akılbek sort of told me. It was like December or January, maybe. You know, he mentioned that his activism was sparked by a personal experience with having a friend who was detained. And then he felt that he had to say something. And he told me, you know, once you start speaking, you know, you realize that, like, they either listen or they don't, but you are doing something. And that, you know, once, you know, if the Uzbek state continues to persecute sort of Karakalpak people, those who have been silent will start speaking, and those who are speaking are going to speak louder. And he said, you know, he said the worst case scenario is that those who are already speaking take actions that are more drastic. And he described that as the worst case scenario. You know, I think that illustrates what a peaceable guy he is, and which sort of throws his detention and the possibility of his extradition even more into sort of stark contrast, that this is somebody that the Uzbek state could have used as the wrong word, but conversed with and start building bridges, but they're not really interested in building bridges. That seems clear. And so I don't really know where this will go, but I guess we should remain hopeful that people will continue to speak up and more people will pay attention. Because, you know, while this applies to a relatively small community in the global scale, this is the kind of oppression that we should sort of be pushing back against everywhere.
Great, thank you. Laila, am I wrong that the situation suddenly seems to be getting worse for Karakalpak activists outside Kazakhstan? Or I mean outside Uzbekistan, excuse me.
Yeah, I agree with you and with Katie. Uzbek authorities, unfortunately, seem to have intensified their attack on Karakalpaks. And I think this is a really big mistake on their part, because it would have been much easier for them to just to engage in conversation and to find some constructive ways to solve this issue with Karakalpaks. And as Katie has mentioned, they are not going anywhere. They're there and they're everywhere. And they are certainly not stopping to talk about their issues. So if Uzbek authorities are still trying, well, not if, we see that they are still trying to paint their, you know, picture in a more positive sort of color, and they are spending so much resources on building that image in the West to show them as this sort of like liberal government that wants to implement reforms in Uzbekistan and are open to the world, to democratic reforms, they should actually show it with their actions. And if there is any criticism coming out, they should learn to take it in a healthy way and react in a healthy way, and not the way they have reacted to. For example, even the side event that we held with Karakalpaks, where the Uzbek authorities, the Uzbek delegation was attacking us the entire week. I mean, this was not the purpose of the side event. The purpose was exactly to kind of, you know, start this conversation between them, between the Uzbek authorities and the Karakalpak minority. So I hope maybe somebody within the Uzbek government will start thinking in that direction. I think that would really be a big change.
Okay, thank you. Steve, and take whatever time you need here, but what do you think? Is the situation getting worse for Karakalpak activists now suddenly?
Well, it's been bad, you know, and it goes through these cycles, and I think as we were saying, and as Leila just mentioned, it's really, and unfortunately, it's not new that we've seen these spikes in repression that come in response to activism at the OSCE conference and other places. And we've also seen, as we've been discussing, a general deterioration of rights and freedoms in Uzbekistan, certainly since the constitutional referendum and Mirziyoyev's re-election. I mean, so many things are not going well. And I think that it's always the canary in the coal mine, or the bellwether, are the treatment of ethnic minorities, issues of autonomy, journalists, and certainly the issue of Karakalpakstan is just not the Achilles heel, but in some way it goes to it's one of those spots in the DNA of the authoritarian governance of Uzbekistan, which goes just right to the heart of the most sensitive questions of whether or not this system can ever be generally representative or democratic or give a voice to its constituent members. And I completely agree with Katie and Leila that the Karakalpak movement has been there. It will be there. They are a part of Uzbekistan. They deserve a voice. Again, the tragedy so much is that people like Daulatmurat Tajmuratov and Akhilbek and others have peacefully tried to engage at every stage in the process, from June 2022 with the announcement of the constitutional amendments, to the response to really the kangaroo court, or these trials that occurred, the show trials, and continual calls, especially by Akhilbek, to have the parliamentary commission led by the ombudswoman for human rights to release their findings. Something that I know I've mentioned on this podcast a few times. We've been waiting and waiting and waiting to see what did that so-called independent commission find? What were its recommendations? The fact that those haven't been released, I think that's really another powerful indictment of the claims made in the first early days after the crisis, after the crackdown and the killings, that the government was trying to distinguish itself from the earlier response to Andijan in 2005. And the fact that that commission was muzzled, its members not really able to speak, I think there's so many elements here that point us to the need for more pressure on Tashkent. I'm really concerned about Daulatmurat's overall health, the torture that we know has occurred. I'm so concerned for the detained activists throughout Kazakhstan. Of course, now this wave of repression that's extending to Europe. I think it speaks to the fact that if we don't address these core issues, the fact that the same old criminal statutes, the ones that I mentioned a few moments ago, get used again and again and again, we're going to keep having this problem. And I also think back to when I visited Karakalpakstan before this crisis happened, a few years before, and I witnessed the most modest signs of opposition, opposition protests that were occurring in Nukus, and I saw the brutality with which the plainclothes officers and security officials, this was in 2020, mind you, approached individuals and arrested them just for holding up flags and signs. That's not a constructive response. That's engineered and designed to create more conflict, more problems. So I'm really hoping that, and let me just throw one more final point into the mix perhaps, is that Uzbekistan has to conduct a census, which they've been avoiding doing for 30 years. So we don't really have, and the state doesn't have, unfortunately, data at its fingertips to actually respond to the real concerns about socioeconomic growth, of the effects of the RLC crisis, the economic needs. We don't even know what the prison population in Uzbekistan is broken down by ethnicity. So I think just this issue of actually governing requires the Uzbek government to engage with the Qarakalpak community as citizens, as members of the polity, rather than as, you know, according to these criminal statutes, as potential extremists or terrorists. So I'm really hopeful that that will change, of course, only with pressure from the international community. And along with that, as I said earlier, we need European migration authorities to get smart and actually, you know, get rid of any condescending notions and, dare I say, racist ones about Central Asians. And we also need Kazakhstan, of course, to live up to its international obligations to protect asylum seekers and also not return anyone to Uzbekistan where they could be faced with the risk of torture.
Okay, thank you. Arzu, you're a representative of the Qarakalpak community. You get the last word. What would you like to say about the situation now and the situation inside the Qarakalpak community?
The situation in Qarakalpakstan is very dire. Anyone who tries to speak up, they are beaten up, they are locked up in the prison, and people who are overseas, they are facing challenges as well. My own family members received death threats and imprisonment threats. Amansa Gituwaev, his family members received death threats as well, and he was convicted as a criminal for just speaking out about the issues in Qarakalpakstan. Overall, I want to tell that Uzbekistan government is very repressive, and the latest case with Akılbay Muratbayev's arrest is the good example. They convicted him for posting OSC videos on his YouTube channel, and those videos are available on the OSC website, and it's not a crime. They're also accusing him for the violence because he encouraged people to turn off their lights for 16 minutes to feel how does it feel for Davlat Murat Tajimuratov being squeezed in the darkness. And Davlat Murat Tajimuratov was sentenced for 16 years. And Uzbek government is saying that it's a crime and it's violence. When I see there is anyone who has clear conscience will say that it's not a crime. Freedom of expression is a fundamental human right enshrined in Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'm immensely grateful to Volker Türk, the top UN Human Rights Commissioner, and Mateo Mikasi, the head of OSC Human Rights Office, for personal visit at Qarakalpakstan. However, the Uzbek government adeptly misrepresented the real issues by allowing only pro-government individuals to speak with these officials. Opening international organizations' offices in Qarakalpakstan could potentially alleviate the challenges faced by Qarakalpak people. It was also positive that the RLC issue was highlighted at COP28. The international community needs to be aware that the substation of funds dedicated for RLC has been significantly misused by the Uzbek government. Therefore, I urge international communities to hold Uzbekistan accountable and directly invest in Qarakalpakstan. The Uzbek government systematically eradicates Qarakalpak language and culture, evident in the rising mass migration of the ethnic Uzbeks from other parts of Uzbekistan to Qarakalpakstan. This unsettling trend includes the rewriting of Qarakalpak history and the renaming of streets. Notably, a major avenue named after prominent Qarakalpak writer has been changed to Uzbekistan Avenue, while with another significant major road in Nukus now bears the name of Uzbek dictator Islam Karimov. I urge international community and Western governments to help Qarakalpak people. And we spoke about the Qarakalpak activists in Europe. And I want to also mention about Qarakalpak activist Karlobay Bekmuratov. He is in Poland. He needs help as well. He is illegal in Poland because Poland is not granting him asylum. But he cannot go back to Uzbekistan. If there is any civil country could help these Qarakalpak activists, it will be very helpful. Thank you so much, and I hope that the international community will listen to our voices. Thank you.
Good way to conclude the program. So thank you, Leila, Steve, Arzu, and Katie, for being with me today. And a big thanks, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mid-East Podcast producer in Washington, D.C., And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thanks very much, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.